This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. ربكم الله الذي خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly. And He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories in Sabah: Iran's president vows revenge for those behind the assassination of a member of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps in Tehran. Russia blames Ukraine for the halt in talks for ending the war, saying it's willing to resume the dialogue with Kiev. Plus, Tunisia's main opposition party rejects President Kais Saied's decision to name members of an advisory committee to draft a new constitution. Thank you for joining us. Iran's president has ordered a serious investigation into the assassination of a member of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps in Tehran. Ebrahim Raisi has pledged revenge for the killing of Colonel Sayyad Khodai. Speaking prior to his trip to Oman, Raisi said the arrogant world powers were involved in the crime. The IRGC colonel was assassinated in his car in front of his home in Tehran on Sunday. He was shot five times by two motorcyclists. Iran's foreign ministry has described the assassination as a terrorist operation and inhumane crime. The ministry said it's regrettable to see countries claiming to be fighting terror are silent on the assassination. U.S. sanctions have severely impacted human rights. That's the grim assessment by a top U.N. human rights official who has slammed the United States for its brutal sanctions against the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Elena Doohan, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights, who was on a mission to Iran from May 7th to 18th, has described U.S. sanctions on Iran as unjustifiable and inhumane.
Iran has been subjected to a broad scope of unilateral sanctions for a long period of time already. In particular, the United States has imposed economic, trade, and financial sanctions on Iran since the late 1970s, with a comprehensive trade ban since 1995, and measures to isolate Iran from the international commercial and financial system. These were expanded in mid-2000 and again after 2010, extending to many economic sectors.
U.S. sanctions also targeted Iran's central bank as well as commercial banks. The EU adopted restrictive measures and comprehensive economic and trade sanctions against Iran in 2010, supplemented by an oil embargo in 2012, and trade prohibitions involving key sectors and the freezing of assets of the Iranian central bank, Iranian shipping and shipbuilding sector, and a number of persons and entities, and restrictions on financial services, as well as exports and imports. In May 2018, Washington unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, under which the international sanctions on the Islamic Republic were eased in exchange for Tehran putting limitations on certain aspects of its nuclear activities. The U.S. then reinstated harsh economic sanctions on Iran and slapped new ones that barred countries and international firms from working with Tehran. Duhan said, the U.S. continues to ban trade and investment in Iran, forcing foreign companies to leave the country for the fear of the sanctions. Many banks and businesses, including pharmaceutical and medical companies around the world, overcomply with sanctions out of fear of potential penalties. The UN rapporteur stated that overcompliance with U.S. sanctions could strip Iranians of their basic rights to health. The top UN human rights official highlighted that applying extraterritorial sanctions on Iranian companies or companies working with Iran is illegal under international law. Duhan added that the sanctions have also hampered Iran's effort to import life-saving medicines due to restrictions on banking transactions.
Human rights in Iran are severely affected by the use of unilateral sanctions. The most close to every single individual's fear is the fear of health. The situation in Iran is the following: that some medicines are produced domestically, at the same time the raw materials are imported. And then it comes the issue again of payments, deliveries, the quality of delivered raw materials. When it comes to the rare or severe diseases, there is no possibility to deliver that.
Commenting on Iran's frozen assets abroad, the UN official said the assets estimated to be around $120 billion need to be unblocked. Duhan began her 11-day visit to Iran on May 7th, a day before the fourth anniversary of the U.S. illegal withdrawal from the JCPOA. She also referred to stalled negotiations in Vienna to bring the U.S. back to the JCPOA, urging the signatories and the U.S. to resume the negotiations. In the end, Duhan called on sanctioning states, the U.S. in particular, to abandon their policy of maximum pressure against Iran and other countries.
UN Special Rapporteur Alina Duhan has highlighted the negative impact of Washington's unilateral coercive measures on Iran, urging their immediate removal. But Iran isn't the only victim of the U.S. sanctions regime. Washington has sanctioned over 22 countries, and one of the most affected is Venezuela, where, based on one report, thousands have died as a result of sanctions.
Economic sanctions are the policy tool of choice for the United States to force countries to bend if they don't follow Washington's foreign policy objectives in many cases. Yet they have failed to bring the desired result, as they might generate some meaningful behavioral change in the targeted or sanctioned country about 40% of time.
We know that sanctions really don't work as far as convincing or having leaderships of different countries change their decision-making or their behavior. So I think over the years we've learned that nothing's going to change with the continued sanctions.
Unilateral sanctions have endangered the humanitarian situation and people's livelihood in Iran, while further affecting the vulnerable strata of the society. In sanctioned countries like Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, Syria, and Yemen, medical equipment is rather outdated, and they suffer shortages of medicine and protective means. One of the reasons is that payment systems are not available to buy and have medicine enter the respective countries. For instance, Iran was the scene of a serious economic and health crisis hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. The embargo put in place by the United States threatened the lives of many Iranians. In what has been termed economic terrorism, Washington attempts to use sanctions as a leverage to overthrow the legitimate governments of other countries, something it has done in the case of Venezuela and Cuba. Whether direct or indirect, most of the U.S. sanctions are not authorized by the United Nations Security Council, and many of them are imposed unilaterally by Washington. In fact, more than two-thirds of the world's countries officially condemn U.S. sanctions as a blatant violation of international law and the UN Charter.
Russia's lead negotiator says Moscow was prepared to resume talks with Ukraine. Vladimir Medinsky says halting the talks was Ukraine's initiative, noting that the ball is in Kiev's court to restart them. The Russian official stressed that his country never refused to engage in dialogue. The two sides have held several rounds of talks since the war began on February the 24th. The Ukrainian and Russian foreign ministers met for talks hosted by Turkey in March that ended without a breakthrough. The meeting was followed by another round in Istanbul, which also was stalled. Ukraine's lead negotiator confirmed last week that the negotiations were put on hold. However, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says diplomacy is the only one way to resolve the ongoing conflict with Russia. France pours cold water on Ukraine's demand for joining the European Union, with a government minister saying that a bid could take at least 15 years to finalize.
We have to be honest. If you say Ukraine is going to join the EU in 6 months or a year or two, you're lying. It's probably in 15 or 20 years. It takes a long time.
Bun was speaking with French Radio J. He said he doesn't want to offer Ukrainians any illusions or lies. French President Emmanuel Macron had previously said that joining the EU would take decades for Ukraine. Macron had also suggested that Ukraine be invited to join a parallel European political community. That offer, however, was not welcomed by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. He denounced the offer as a compromise and said his country should quickly join the EU. Ukraine made a demand after the Russian war began there in late February. Russia has launched fresh attacks in Ukraine's Donbass and Mykolaiv regions as it seeks to secure and expand its gains in the country's east and south. Russia's defense ministry says they pounded Ukrainian positions and artillery and with artillery and airstrikes. The ministry says three command posts and four ammunition depots were hit. Also, over a dozen areas where Ukrainian troops and military equipment amassed were struck. Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials say eight civilians have been killed in the Donbass region. They say Russia bombarded Kharkiv in the northeast and Zaporizhia in the southeast. Russia launched its war in Ukraine on February the 24th. The most important city it has so far taken control of is Mariupol, a strategic port in southeast Ukraine. In an exclusive report, our correspondent in Ukraine, Johnny Miller, investigates the alleged single most deadly war crime of the conflict so far. Have a look.
The drama theater of Mariupol. It is the scene of the alleged single most deadly war crime so far in this brutal conflict. Depending on who you believe, it was either a Russian airstrike or done by the Ukrainians to blame it on Russia. The words children are still scrawled on the pavement outside, written in order to ward off a Russian strike.
I talked to emergency workers a week ago. Our fire brigade is over there, and they told me they found two more dead bodies.
He breaks down and walks away, unnecessarily ashamed of his tears.
I lost everything. What is left for me here? I have worked here all my life.
This is the second time that I've been here in the last few days. Since the last time, there's a little bit more rubble being cleared up. Interestingly, you can just walk straight in, even though it's a crime scene or a former crime scene, and still a site where it's still pretty dangerous in places. But you can walk straight in, it's that easy. But finding out just what happened here is a little harder. At the very least, I wanted to find out just how many people had died here. Estimates range from around 30 to over 600. A workman took me down to the basement, but told me his team had only recovered three bodies from the rubble. He also grumbled that they could have worked much faster if they hadn't been ordered to remove brick by brick, due to, as he called them, fake stories about hundreds underneath. Some eyewitnesses and previous media reports say that there were over 100 outside the theatre at a field kitchen. None survived, they said. This is Alexander. He says he was sheltering in a basement nearby and came to the theatre the morning after the explosion.
We thought there would be between 500 to 1,000 dead. There are three floors, but only 20 bodies were dug out, which means the others were led out from the theatre. Outside, beside the kitchen, there were 15 bodies, thank God.
Witnesses say there was 100 people outside at a food shelter, and they were all killed. Is that what you saw?
No, they only found 20 inside the basement and 15 outside. That's all. We thought that there were 1,000 dead, and we were going around these ruins shouting if there was anyone alive still. There were arms and legs. It's difficult to put it into words.
Alexander also finds it hard to hold back the tears. If this was a Russian strike, it would still constitute a war crime. But have the figures been exaggerated to cause greater uproar?
There is a famous Russian journalist and TV personality. I've spoken to them. They are unsurprisingly very clear that this was a Ukrainian strike to blame on the Russians. But there isn't just a battle in
on the ground here in Ukraine, there's also a propaganda war as Russia seeks to justify its invasion, and NATO and Ukraine seek to make Russia out to be committing heinous war crimes.
At the nearest hospital, I speak to a medic who was working at the time of the explosion.
Maybe it was a strike from the air. According to another account, it was mined and detonated. I cannot say for sure. It's not clear.
Why couldn't you get to the theater as an ambulance driver?
At that time, the Russian military didn't let us go to the theater. There were battles going on nearby.
If Alexander's testimony is to be believed, and if the workmen are correct about there being few bodies in the rubble, then did the Russians take away hundreds of bodies in the hours after the explosion, in which they took control of the area and before the morning? Possibly. In an honest world, an independent investigation would be carried out to find out what happened and how many people died. But for now, as the war continues to rage, that seems unlikely. As they say, history is written by the winners. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
Tunisia's main opposition party, Ennahda, has rejected President Kais Saied's decision to form an advisory committee to draft a new constitution. The party said the measure was a complete deviation from constitutional legitimacy. It added that a referendum on the matter would lack credibility because the country's legislature had been dissolved by the president. Ennahda called on other parties to unify efforts to restore democracy and save the country from the dangers of economic collapse. On Friday, Saied named a law professor to head the advisory committee that will draft a new constitution. The committee will submit its report to the president in late June. Tunisia has been in a deep political crisis since June 2021, when Saied dismissed the government, suspended parliament, and assumed executive authority. The move was decried by opponents as a coup. Hamas says there will be no let-up in Palestinian people's resistance against the Israeli regime. Chief of the resistance movement's political bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, made the comments in a televised speech on the anniversary of Palestinian Operation Sword of Quds. During that operation, Palestinian groups in Gaza fired thousands of rockets into Israel in response to a brutal bombing campaign against Gaza. Haniyeh said the operation targeted the Israeli regime's security and that it was not limited to a specific geographical territory, but was a strategic battle with a global spillover effect. He also warned Tel Aviv against desecrating the Al-Aqsa Mosque, adding Palestinians will not tolerate any sacrilegious moves.
Hundreds of Palestinians attended a national conference in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the first anniversary of the victory of Palestinian resistance against the Israeli regime in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, fired more than 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli aggressions on Palestinians in Al-Quds' Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. During the battle, Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. Addressing the conference via satellite, the head of the political bureau of Hamas movement, Ismail Haniyeh, warned the Israeli regime against holding the so-called flag march in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the Sword of Al-Quds battle will be a walk in the park compared to any future battles with Palestinian resistance groups. The Zionists must not test our patience, and they must stop their provocations, especially in Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians believe that the Sword of Al-Quds battle has united their ranks. During the 11-day war, all Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip worked together through the Joint Chamber of Military Operations.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinians were united together against the Israeli forces. The Sword of Al-Quds battle exposed the weakness of the Israeli regime. The Palestinian people in Gaza, in Al-Quds, and in the occupied West Bank will always fight for their rights.
Palestinian resistance groups have been holding military maneuvers following the Sword of Al-Quds battle to confront any new Israeli war amid the increasing warmongering rhetoric by the Israeli regime.
Observers say that Palestinian resistance groups fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime last year, forcing Tel Aviv to declare a unilateral ceasefire. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
That's your world news for now.
Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
in the limelight.
According to a report, the Israeli regime used weapons made and funded by the United States to destroy projects and businesses in the Gaza Strip during its devastating 11-day war on the besieged enclave last year. We present you an article written by Daniel Bogoslov. The piece is titled, Israel Used U.S. Weapons to Destroy Assets and Aid Projects in Gaza. The article has appeared on the front page of the Intercept website. Last May, in an assault on the occupied Gaza Strip, the Israeli regime deployed hundreds of bombs, missiles and shells, murdering over 240 Palestinians and wounding more than 1,900 others. Despite Zionist regime's claims that it only targets combatants from Hamas and other Palestinian resistance groups, more than half of the martyred were civilians. At the end of the 11-day assault, tens of thousands of Gazans were displaced from damaged homes, already struggling in a region with a 50% unemployment rate, toxic water, and crumbling infrastructure. Thousands of housing units, hundreds of schools, and 19 healthcare facilities were damaged. Documents and reporting reviewed by The Intercept show compounding the devastating toll on Palestinian civilians, weapons made and funded by the United States were used to destroy humanitarian projects and businesses in Gaza. The destruction reached multiple hospitals, water treatment facilities, and dozens of schools operated by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Near East, or UNRWA. Raad Jarar, Advocacy Director at Democracy for the Arab World Now, told The Intercept, "The vast majority of ammunition used by Israel is manufactured or subsidized by the United States." Raad Jarar added, "It's fair to say that every Israeli munition is subsidized by the United States one way or another by U.S. tax dollars. Impoverished in no small part thanks to a decade-and-a-half-long Israeli blockade, the Gaza Strip relies heavily on foreign aid to avert the worst humanitarian outcomes." According to documents compiled from the United Nations, the Palestinian Authority and human rights groups, more than 100 UNRWA facilities in Gaza were damaged in the 11-day bombing campaign in May of 2021, requiring over $1 million in repairs. Dozens more schools administered by the Palestinian Authority suffered similar damage. In 2014, during an earlier Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip, a Hellfire missile manufactured and paid for by the United States targeted an UNRWA school, murdering 10 civilians. The massacre drew widespread condemnation, even eliciting a rare rebuke from the Obama administration, whose press secretary decried it as totally indefensible. Michael Link, the recently departed United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of humanitarian rights in the Palestinian territories, said, "A major reason for the perpetuation of Israeli occupation and the deaths and suffering which accompany it is the extraordinary military, diplomatic and political support given to it, largely without conditions, by the United States." Michael Link added, "This American military assistance is provided, notwithstanding the fact that congressional laws governing U.S. weapons exports claim that recipient countries cannot be engaged in consistent patterns of gross human rights violations. While Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. military aid, it is subject to virtually no checks in operation, ensuring that U.S. weapons are not used to commit war crimes, destroy United Nations-funded projects, or damage the property of civilians in the Gaza Strip," Since 1948, the United States has provided the Israeli regime with over $150 billion worth in assistance, receiving in exchange a foothold in a region of massive strategic importance. The current model exists under a Memorandum of Understanding that President Barack Obama signed in 2016, committing to $38 billion in aid between 2019 and 2028, with an open-door policy for additional aid, like the $1 billion Congress gave the Zionist regime in March for its Iron Dome missile defense system. The aid system also provides cash flow financing, a system resembling layaway that allows Israel to purchase weapons in the present using money from the future. And it contains an offshore procurement exemption offered to no other country that allows the Israeli regime to spend U.S. tax dollars on its own weapons industry without disclosing how it spent the money to Congress or the American public. And of course, the United States maintains its own stockpiled weapons in the occupied Palestinian territories, available for use by the Israeli forces, despite Israel's status as one of the largest arms exporters in the world. In two instances, Israel tapped into the U.S. stockpile to wage campaigns against the Palestinian resistance group Hamas and the Lebanese Islamic resistance movement Hezbollah. The end result is an Israeli arsenal almost entirely composed of weapons made or subsidized by the United States. As bombs fell on the Gaza Strip last May, the smell of roasting nuts and sizzling potatoes was replaced with the overwhelming stench of burnt plastic. A potato chip factory and a Matouk ice cream factory, which once produced snacks in the hope of instilling a glimmer of joy in the blockaded strip, were completely destroyed in the bombing. Many of the companies established in Gaza's industrial zone did so under the pretext that the Israeli military would not bomb the commercial site. Financed by U.S. aid and fired on by U.S.-funded weapons, the area was thought to be protected under the auspices of the Oslo Accords, which created a special economic zone intended to supplant conflict with mutually beneficial free trade. Also impacted were the Foamco mattress factory, the main producer of mattresses for Gaza, the Abu Iskandar plastic factory, the Clever detergent factory, the Siksik plastic pipes factory, and the Al-Wadi food plant, resulting in tens of millions of dollars worth of damage. The factories employed 1,500 Palestinians and were severely impacted by the shelling in the early morning hours on 17th and 18th of May 2021. The Al-Ahli Arab Hospital, which received a $900,000 grant from UNAID to build a surgery center, was also damaged in the Israeli bombing campaign, as was Beit Hanun Hospital, another recipient of UNAID funding. While mechanisms for punishing war crimes perpetrated with U.S. support are selectively enforced against many other countries, the lack of scrutiny over the Israeli regime's forces' use of American weaponry is glaring. Amid last May's onslaught, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace detailed a number of U.S. laws violated by Israel's attacks on Gaza. These included the Foreign Assistance Act, which stipulates that aid cannot be provided to a country which engages in a consistent pattern of gross violations of internationally recognized human rights. Also, the Arms Export Control Act, which bans U.S. military assistance to countries using weapons for reasons other than legitimate self-defense. And the Leahy Laws, named after outgoing U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, which ban weapon sales to military units that have committed a gross violation of human rights. In May of 2021, as last year's bombing campaign drew to a close, Senator Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, and several progressive members of the House of Representatives introduced resolutions to block a $735 million weapons package that included the same type of precision-guided bombs that the Israeli regime was already using to shell Gaza. Senator Bernie Sanders said at the time, "I believe that the United States must help lead the way to a peaceful and prosperous future for both Israelis and Palestinians. We need to take a hard look at whether the sale of these weapons is actually helping do that or whether it is simply fueling conflict." But the White House demurred. Then White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki claimed, "We have seen reports of a move towards a potential ceasefire. That is clearly encouraging." The Biden administration approved the sale. This May, Israel launched another bombing campaign on the Gaza Strip.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly program that will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the worst economic and political crisis faced by the island nation of Sri Lanka, a crisis rooted in fiscal mismanagement by successive governments. And we shall also take a look at growing relations between regional powers India and Japan and the factors that have bolstered their strategically driven relationship.
Sri Lanka, a small island nation located off the southern coast of India, is grappling with its biggest economic meltdown, which has fueled the political crisis and violent protests, the worst the country has seen since its independence in 1948. What began as peaceful demonstrations in late February over soaring inflation, shortage of food, and fuel and power outages have gradually morphed into a countrywide uprising. Amid the unprecedented turmoil, the sitting premier has forced to resign, but the president continues to hold the fort.
Violence in the island country erupted after a month of peaceful demonstrations over the dire economic situation that has affected all sections of Sri Lankan society. Lengthy blackouts, record inflation, and shortage of food and medicine forced people into the streets against the family-run government. To foil the popular agitation, a nationwide curfew was imposed, and the military was heavily deployed, but not before 9 people were killed and over 225 were wounded. The unrest and violence in the last 2 weeks is the worst the island country has seen since the 2019 Easter bombing. Angry protesters who have been demanding the ouster of President Gotabaya Rajapaksa have been attacked by pro-government mobs. Earlier, the president's brother and prime minister, Mahinda Rajapaksa, resigned under public pressure and fled to a notorious torture camp in the Tamil-majority region northeast. He was replaced by Ranil Wickremesinghe, a seasoned politician who has in the past been accused of facilitating corruption and fanning the long-standing ethnic conflict. The crisis in the country of 22 million is rooted in economic mismanagement by successive governments. The country has now been forced to turn to the International Monetary Fund for aid after months of denial. But that seems insufficient to pacify protesters who want a complete political shake-up, including the resignation of President Rajapaksa.
While the unprecedented economic crisis threatens to upend the nation of 22 million people, it has also caused the staggering fall of the country's most powerful political dynasty. The Rajapaksa family dominated Sri Lanka's political scene for almost 2 decades. The family's dramatic collapse was triggered by an economic crisis caused by decades of fiscal mismanagement and aggravated by populist policies. The stress eventually led to a crash. Now, most of the family members are in hiding, except the embattled president himself.
Early murmurs of the unrest were heard in late February. But it was not until early April that peaceful protests gained momentum across the small island country. The key demand raised by protesters was the resignations of the two powerful brothers, the president and prime minister. When his supporters attacked anti-government protesters, sparking clashes across the country, Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa was forced to resign. He soon had to be evacuated from his besieged home and whisked away to a safe location. While his resignation was widely welcomed, President Gotabaya Rajapaksa's refusal to walk away infuriated anti-government protesters and added fuel to the fire. Although he offered some concessions and appointed veteran politician Ranil Wickremesinghe as the new premier, protesters in the Buddhist-majority country see his exit important for the country's economic recovery.
Mr. President and also Prime Minister and also members of Parliament, please step down and stop this violence. Don't disturb us, don't disturb people, because people are suffering. You all are playing the game. You all are playing the game. So we want to say, please step down and leave us alone.
The new Prime Minister has invited the opposition to form a unity government, but they have made it conditional on President Rajapaksa's resignation. Without a stable government in place, observers believe it will be difficult for Sri Lanka to negotiate a loan with the International Monetary Fund. The efforts to seek financial help from neighboring India and China will also be hampered amid a political crisis in the country.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Shiran Ilamperuma, an independent journalist and researcher. Welcome to the program, sir. Now, the small island nation of Sri Lanka is embroiled in its worst economic crisis, which has led to violent protests. Do you think it was inevitable given the economic mismanagement by successive governments?
Yeah, first of all, thanks for having me on your show and on your channel. As you said, it has been successive policy missteps by governments since Sri Lanka achieved independence from the British in 1948 that has led us to this point. there are structural weaknesses in the Sri Lankan economy, being basically since the time of colonialism, a plantation economy, an export-oriented plantation economy. Since the 1940s and 50s, we've been relying on exports of agricultural raw materials like tea, rubber, and coconut. And you know, obviously, this is not enough to sustain a nation that that imports manufactures from other countries, and this leads to constant trade deficits and pressure on the currency, which leads to devaluation and inflation. It's a vicious cycle that only industrialization, and especially, you know, at some point, export-oriented industrialization can solve. And no government has been able to implement this with a proper vision and maintain it for a long enough time. I think the current crisis in many ways exposes the Sri Lankan economy for what it has always been, right? In 1977, when the Sri Lankan economy was liberalized and opened up and you know, connected more deeply with the global economy, we were not able to produce enough, to export enough to justify our imports. And that balance, it was basically met through a very superficial consumption-oriented service sector, predominantly tourism. And at the same time, we were exporting our labor to the Gulf countries in the Middle East. And the remittances from those workers was what we used, along with tourism revenue, to balance out the trade deficit. I think what the COVID-19 pandemic and now the war in Ukraine have done is basically strip Sri Lanka from those two crutches, and it exposes the real economy, the real state of the economy.
Now let's talk about the Rajapaksas. The family has been accused of fanning the decades-old ethnic conflict in Sri Lanka by leading a brutal war against LTTE, repressing minority Tamils and Muslims. How do you see their fall from grace?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I think, of course, the narrative of the Rajapaksas vis-a-vis the minorities and the civil war, that's very well known internationally, and it's part of the one sort of narrative that is allowed in Western media. It's not that this is entirely a false narrative. Of course, there's truth in it. Of course, there is a degree of ethnic chauvinism embedded in the Rajapaksa political project. But you know, one thing I just want to clarify is that this sort of negates the actual electoral base of the Rajapaksa family, which is in the south and in the rural regions. And if you actually go to these parts of Sri Lanka in the deep south and in very rural, unindustrialized areas where people depend on paddy farming, you know, smallholder agriculture, fisheries, you know, you will find that ethnic chauvinism doesn't really sell, because these people have real issues, right? What makes them gravitate towards the Rajapaksas is the sort of economic incentives. Basically, the Rajapaksas coming from a nominally center-left nationalist background means that they respond to the rural electorate by giving them, you know, bare minimum, you know, agricultural subsidies, for example, subsidized fuel, subsidized fertilizer, and protection for domestic industries. So the electoral base of the Rajapaksas, despite being of the majority community, is dependent more on these economic relationships. The chauvinism and the racial dynamics, they feature more heavily in the urban sectors, actually, in places like Colombo, where most of the chauvinistic politicians are elected from Colombo. And because that's where the economic competition between rural to urban migrants and minorities in the trading sector is most intense.
Mr. Ilan Promo, how important is a stable and united government in Colombo for the country to recover from the economic meltdown and political crisis? And do you think President Rajapaksa's resignation is a panacea?
I think a stable government is very much a necessity and a precondition to bring some semblance of normalcy. I think at this point, every political party in the country has to come together on some sort of common minimum program that will prioritize, first of all, providing essentials to the Sri Lankan people, you know, petrol, gas, food, all of those things, you know, electricity, so that the real economy can function. There also needs to be a stable government to negotiate with the IMF, to negotiate with our bilateral partners for bridge financing, and to eventually start negotiations on restructuring our external debt. In terms of the resignation of the president, that is a strong demand that comes from a lot of the protesters in Colombo, and I think a significant amount of people in rural areas would agree with it. I personally don't see that as a panacea, because what it would do is create a power vacuum, and it's not clear from the protesters on the ground who the alternative is, because there has yet to be a leader to sort of step up and be willing to fill that vacuum.
Mr. Ilan Peruma, thank you for being on the program. Glad to have you with us. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
A Johns Hopkins economist, Steve Hank, refers to soaring food prices and violent protests in Sri Lanka and says protesters have burnt down the homes of 38 politicians as the country plunges into further chaos. Jairam Ramesh, former Indian minister and lawmaker, says the roots of Sri Lanka's crisis lie not just in short-term economics, but more in linguistic, religious and cultural majoritarianism over the past decades. Political commentator and author Ashok Swain points to Rajapaksa's family's appeal of the majority ethnic community and hate politics against Tamil Hindus and Muslims, saying the economic disaster has brought Buddhist monks to the streets.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
India and Japan, the two regional stalwarts, mark 70 years of their diplomatic relations this year. The partnership between them has steadily progressed over the years, especially after the two countries became special strategic and global partners in 2015. Japan's role as a shaper of India's regional engagement and broader global outlook has been significant. Now let's take a look at what in particular has bolstered their strategically driven relationship in their close synergy in the Indo-Pacific region and opposition to China's rise.
The Japanese envoy to India recently boasted that the relationship between the two countries is at its strongest point in history, with New Delhi being a strategic and global partner of Tokyo. Regional observers contend that the two countries as aspiring global powers are perfectly positioned to bring a non-Western perspective to discourse on the emerging global order. Japanese Premier Fumio Kishida's visit to India in March 2022 was significant for multiple reasons. While bilateral agreements signed during the visit will see $42 billion in Japanese investments in India, the visit also reaffirmed Japan's role in shaping India's regional and international engagement. Tokyo has played a key role in India's Look East policy by backing its membership in regional forums such as the East Asia Summit and investing in infrastructure connecting India and East Asia. The partnership between India and Japan has been primarily driven by their aversion to a Sino-centric regional and global order, which also prompted them to join the Quad. While their collaboration had so far focused on the Indo-Pacific region, it is now slowly extending beyond that. This was reflected in the joint statement issued by the two sides during PM Kishida's India visit, emphasizing a special strategic and global partnership. But disagreements remain, especially on the Ukraine war, where they find each other on opposite sides. Quad, by the way, stands for the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, which is a strategic security dialogue between Australia, India, Japan, and the United States that is maintained by talks between member countries.
India and Japan have traditionally exercised strategic self-restraint in their respective foreign policies, mainly due to Japan's so-called Pacific Constitution and India's non-alignment. Both have for long shied away from asserting themselves on the big stage. But this is changing now. With rapidly changing regional and global dynamics, both countries have begun to develop more proactive foreign policies. On the Ukraine conflict, both have adopted strong but contrasting positions. And on China, the two countries have taken calculated risks.
A series of border skirmishes with China in recent years has prompted India to slowly abandon its adherence to the overarching principle of non-alignment and leapfrog into the Western bloc and its informal groupings like Quad. New Delhi has in particular shown great enthusiasm in forging closer ties with countries that don't see themselves as allies of China. Japan, on the other hand, has moved to recalibrate its positions on regional and global affairs in a departure from the country's pacifist foreign policies. Both countries, however, see China's phenomenal rise differently and have framed their responses accordingly. India's relationship with China is shaped by a long-standing power differential rooted in India's defeat in the 1962 war. The recent deadly clashes in the Ladakh region have only accentuated those fault lines. Japan's partnership has been shaped by its age-old cultural and historical ties with China, but that has not deterred it from conducting war games with the US in case of the event of a conflict with China over Taiwan. On Ukraine, both states have different postures. Japan has followed its allies, the United States and Australia, in condemning Russia's military operation and endorsing international economic sanctions against Russia. On the other hand, India has defied its Quad partner states and taken a neutral position while continuing to buy discounted Russian oil.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Dr. Satoru Nagao, an expert on India's military strategy at the Japan-US-India Security Corporation. Welcome to the program, Dr. Nagao. Now, let's begin with India and Japan's 70 years of diplomatic relations. Can you tell us how far have the two regional heavyweights come to become special strategic and global partners?
Okay, the last 70 years, the relation has moved. Progressed very much. But when our relation has progressed? Indeed, the last 20 years, our relation has progressed, especially since 2000. The relation has progressed a lot. So before the 2000 and after the 2000, completely different. Now we are the strategic partner. But before it, despite that there was no problem between two countries, we are not strategic partner. So now is a good time, best time for India and Japan relations.
Dr. Nagao, how do you assess Japan's role as a shaper of India's regional engagement and broader global outlook, especially the role it has played in India's Look East policy?
Japan focusing on the Indo-Pacific instead of Asia-Pacific, Japan focusing on Quad instead of just the U.S. circle, U.S., Japan, Australia. Why? Because Japan started focusing on India. But why Japan focusing on India? The reason is China. China is dominating the big region, both sides, the Pacific side and the Indian Ocean side. And Japan need to deal with this situation. For India, situation is same. India starts a look east policy in 1990s. Why? Because India tried to find a new chance to develop the cooperation with the east side. It's a new chance. It's a Southeast Asia or Japan as located east side of India. But at the same time, the new threat is rising, which is China. Traditional threat, but after the Cold War, China is rising very fast, and China is a big threat for India too. So for Japan, China is a threat. For India, China is a threat. Now, India and Japan should cooperate. That's why the Indo-Pacific vision, the Japan's vision, and look east policy, India's policy, combined, share the same interests.
Dr. Nagao, the partnership between New Delhi and Tokyo has been mainly driven by their antipathy to Sino-centric regional and global order. So how have the two countries framed their responses to China's rise?
When you are a Chinese leader to defend China from other threats, what should you do? In this case, they need to decide to share of the China's military budget against Japan, against India, against others. If India and Japan cooperate each other, China need to divide their defense budget against India, against Japan. In this case, it is more easy for India and Japan to maintain military balance with China. And this is very important because what happened in the South China Sea indicates one pattern of China's territorial expansion. When France withdrew from Indochina, China occupied half of the Paracel Island. When US withdrew from Vietnam, China occupied another half of the Paracel Island. When the Soviet Union reduced the number of troops in Vietnam, China occupied Spratly Island. When US troops withdrew from Philippines, China occupied Mischief Reef. Every time when the military balance has changed and when there is a power vacuum, China steals it. If so, maintaining military balance is most important way to deter China. If India and Japan cooperate with other US-Australia cooperate, China need to divide their defense budget multi-direction. In this case, it is more easy to maintain military balance. That's why India and Japan share the same interest.
On that note, I would like to thank Dr. Nagao from Japan for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Mahesh Puttapaka, a journalist based in India, cites a newspaper article to assert that if partnership between India and Japan is to enhance regional security and prosperity,